About 10 years ago, they did a survey asking people if they believe in God or were associated with any type of religious group. And about 91% of the people that were surveyed said yes, they did believe in God or were associated with some type of religion. They did that survey about 10 years later, asked the same demographic of people, the same questions. And the percentage of people who said they did not believe in God or were not associated with some type of religion bumped up to about 15%. About 85% still continued to say they believed in God or were associated with some type of religion. About 14 to 15% said they did not believe in God or were not associated with any type of religious body. That was a percentage point increase of about 5 to 6 percentage points. Interestingly, that was the fastest growing group in the United States of America. Unbelief and non-religious. If you had asked me when I was growing up, Kyle, do you know someone who does not believe in God who would be classified as an atheist? I grew up in Columbia, Tennessee, just below Nashville. I ran with a group of young Christians between 15 and 18. Our group probably consisted of about 100 kids from about three or four primary youth groups there in town, West 7th, Graymere, a couple more. If you would have asked all of us from 15 to 18 years old, do you know someone who believes that there is no God? I dare say out of 100 of us, you wouldn't have had one or two who would have said, yes, we know someone who is an atheist. In fact, I don't think that I shook hands with a person that I knew for a fact was an atheist probably until I was about, I'm going to say, 22, 23 years old. I teach a Bible class at Maywood Christian Camp. I teach the 15 through 18 year olds every full week, the first week after the 4th of July. I've been doing it now, I guess, for about 4 years or so. And so, just for kicks, I decided I'd ask them, starting about 3 or 4 years ago, how many of them know someone who is an atheist? Now, the first time I asked that question, I had about 42 kids in my class. Out of the 42, 32 of them said they knew someone who was an atheist. I asked again the next year, had about 40 in my class. Out of the 40, about 30 of them said they knew someone who was an atheist. I had about 52 or so the next year. I asked them, about 40 of them out of the 52 said they knew someone who was an atheist. Several of them came up to me, explained to me that they had friends who are atheists. One of the young men sitting in the class at Maywood Christian Camp, I think it was last year, maybe 2 years ago, came up to me afterwards and said, I am an atheist. And here's why. And so we had a discussion with him for an hour and a half, 2 hours or so, talking about the evidence for the existence of God and other things along those lines. We are at a time in the United States of America that our country has never seen the proportion of unbelief. And I say that to say, when I was growing up, I never would have thought we would need to lay the foundation for the existence of God and prepare our young people to be able to defend those basic beliefs in the existence of God and to be able to look into the consequences of beliefs like atheism. I just didn't think that that was going to be something that would be on our horizon. But it is. In fact, on a regular basis, as I travel around the country, I see the need to understand where unbelief leads. And that's what we're going to do this evening and tomorrow evening. We're going to ask ourselves a simple question. We won't be dealing with the existence of God, positive evidence for that. That has been done at this congregation before, I think a year or so ago. We have information that deals with that. What we will be asking ourselves is this. What are the logical implications of unbelief? If a person accepts the idea that there is no God, where would that end that person up if he or she were to act as if that belief were true? A man by the name of George Walser decided that he would found a town on the idea of unbelief. His idea was that a society based on atheism would be very productive, would be very wholesome, and that if he gathered enough of these people who believed that there was no God together, he could start a town that would be an example of productive infidelity to the rest of the United States of America. That was his stated goal. He wanted to show people that unbelief is a good philosophical foundation for a productive society. And so he started a city by the name, it was more like a town, by the name of Liberal, Missouri. I took these pictures, I'm going to say about 7 years ago now, when I was doing a meeting in Lamar, Missouri. It's about 45 minutes outside of Liberal. You can see that Liberal has a population now of about 779. The town is still in existence. If you were to look at some of the street signs, like Walzer Avenue, you would see that they were named after George Walzer himself, the founder of the town. You would see Darwin Drive, named after Charles Darwin. You would see Ingersoll Lane, named after the very famous skeptic Robert Ingersoll. There is a Paine Drive for Thomas Paine and some other very well-known unbelievers of the time. Now, this was done in 1880 to 1885, somewhere along there. A man by the name of Clark Braden, who, if I understand correctly, was a member of the Lord's Church, was a traveling preacher and debater, decided that he was going to go visit Liberal, Missouri. He was going to see just how well this infidel experiment was going. And so he did, went to visit Liberal, Missouri. And he wrote an article in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in 1885. Where he reported on what he saw in Liberal. He said that the hotels had become brothels, that everybody cussed, the women and the children. He said all of the children were disobedient, none of them could be contained. He said the property value had sunk so low that the majority of people in Liberal would get out if they could, but they couldn't because they were losing so much money, so they were stuck there. He reported on what he saw, basically. Well, of course, the people in Liberal, Missouri did not take that sitting down. They didn't appreciate what he had to tell them. And so Clark Braden was for $25,000. And in 1885, $25,000 was a considerable sum of money. He was sued by one of the hotel owners that he had referred to as one of those hotels that had become a brothel. That hotel owner sued Clark Braden, but the case never went to court. In fact, if I understand it correctly, what happened was that Clark Braden's information was so factual, so well-founded and well-documented, he could not have been accused of libel or slander. The case was thrown out of court, and the person who sued him had to pay all of the court costs. Clark Braden said this was a failed infidel experiment. His thesis was in the article, unbelief is not a philosophy or idea upon which you can base or found a productive society. If you were to take Liberal, Missouri as an example, you would see that he was exactly right. Is that true? Is unbelief an unproductive philosophy that would lead to moral decay and that would lead to a society that would not be productive, that would not be wholesome, that would not be livable? Well, that's what we're going to explore this evening. George Walzer, later in his life, realized that his experiment had failed. In fact, he came in contact with the teachings of Jesus Christ and decided he did not want to be buried in Liberal, Missouri, the city that he had founded. Instead, he wanted to be buried in Lamar, Missouri, 45 minutes away, because he came in contact with the teachings found in the New Testament that Jesus Christ spoke, and he turned from his infidelity. What if a society bases its standards on unbelief? What would happen in that case? Well, that's what we'll explore this evening, the fruits of atheism. Now, before we explore the fruits of atheism, let me show you a very brief quote about the fruits of Christianity. Now, I'm going to flip through a couple. Now, before you read this, I want you to read the very bottom of this. I want you to read who said this statement. His name was Bertrand Russell. He was a very well-known agnostic, atheist agnostic. He swapped from one to the other several times, if I understand it correctly. And he wrote an article titled, "Why I Am Not a Christian." This man was not a friend of Christianity. He was not trying to promote Christianity in any sense. He would think that if you are a Christian, then you are believing some things that aren't true and that it's not necessarily wholesome for your life and lots of things you should change, etc. So don't think that this man is a friend of Christianity at all. But I want you to see the statement that he makes about Christianity. He says, as soon as it conquered the state, Christianity put an end to the gladiatorial shows. He says, not because they were cruel, but because they were idolatrous. The result, however, was to diminish the widespread education in cruelty by which the populace of Roman towns were degraded. Christianity also did much to soften the lot of slaves. It established charity on a large scale, inaugurated hospitals. Although the great majority of Christians failed lamentably in Christian charity, the ideal remained alive. And in every age inspired some notable saints. In a new form, it passed over modern liberalism and remains the inspiration of much that is most hopeful in our somber world. Now, Mr. Russell, do you believe that a person should be a Christian? No. In fact, I'm going to write an article, an essay, "Why I Am Not a Christian," and here are the reasons why. Okay, Mr. Russell, even though you don't believe that Christianity is true, what would happen if everybody acted like a Christian? What would happen if everybody acted like a Christian? Well, he says, Christianity would soften the lot of slaves. It established charity on a large scale. It inaugurated hospitals. He said, Christianity remains the inspiration behind much that is most hopeful in our somber world. Now, let's ask this. Would you like to live in a place where people treated others like they wanted to be treated? Wouldn't that be a wonderful neighborhood? If there was a spirit of consideration to such a degree that you were treated exactly like the other person would want you to treat them. What if you lived in a society where everybody looked out not only for his own interests, but for the interests of others? What if you lived in a place where nothing was done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, people esteemed others better than themselves? Wouldn't that be an exciting place to live? What if you lived in a place where even when someone did bad to another person, was cruel or unkind, that person did not repay evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, that person blessed the person who was cruel and unkind to them? What if you lived in a place where people let brotherly love continue, where they were kind-hearted toward one another, where they were forgiving? Wouldn't that be a wonderful place to live? Well, you see, those are all principles that are stated emphatically and repeatedly in the New Testament. If every single person acted like Jesus Christ and put into practice the teachings of Jesus Christ, do you think that's where you would want to live? Well, certainly. And Bertrand Russell recognizes that. He says, you know what? A lot of the Christians didn't behave right. They didn't put into practice Christianity. But if they had, well, the philosophy of Christianity remains the inspiration behind much that is most hopeful in our somber world. Now, the fruits of true Christianity are evident. All you have to do to understand that is to state them. Love your enemies. Pray for those who hurt you. Do unto others as you want them to do to you, etc. What are the fruits of atheism? The first thing that we have to ask ourselves is, how in the world would a person, would a philosophy of unbelief go about answering what should be done or what should not be done? And if we were going to go to the philosophy of atheism and say, okay, according to atheism, how do you arrive at what's right and what's wrong? Well, what you're going to find very quickly is you cannot arrive at right and wrong. William Provine, who, if you were to have seen the movie Expelled by Ben Stein, he was the taller gentleman. I think he's about 6'2", 6'3", or so. He was the bald-headed gentleman that had a brain tumor that was very boisterous in his discussion of atheism. He's very famous, well-known for his atheism. He was invited to speak on the campus of the University of Tennessee in Knoxville for their Darwin Day celebration. And in that speech, the summary of his five main points is what you see on the screen in front of you. He said naturalistic evolution, and when he says naturalistic, what that means is atheistic. The idea that there's nothing more than nature, there's nothing more than matter. He says naturalistic evolution has clear consequences that Charles Darwin understood perfectly. He said one of those is that no gods worth having exist, that no life after death exists. And now look at number three. That no ultimate foundation for ethics exists, no ultimate meaning in life exists, and human free will is non-existent. Now each of those we could take time, about probably an entire hour, and have a lecture on if we wanted to, but I'm just going to focus on that point number three. No ultimate foundation for ethics exists. Now if you know your Old Testament very well, you're probably familiar with the statement made in Psalm 14:1. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. That is a rather famous statement that people who do not believe in God often go to and say, this statement is offensive, this statement is caustic toward unbelief. When the Bible says that the fool says in his heart there is no God, what the Bible means by that is there is some type of wrong thinking going on in a person's mind who adopts that idea. That statement is made because the evidence available shows that there is a God. I can understand how a person would be offended at that statement. However, that statement is true. If the evidence that's available points to the conclusion that there is a God, then you would have to be thinking incorrectly somehow to arrive at the conclusion that there is not one. Now, if you do arrive at the conclusion that there is not one, I want you to notice what the rest of that passage says. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable things. There is none who does good, no, not one. Now, right there, the unbeliever is going to have a problem. And I understand exactly what the problem would be. The unbeliever would stop right there and say, wait just a second. Are you telling me that if a person says he's a Christian, he's going to do right? And if a person says he doesn't believe in God, he's going to be highly immoral and is going to be a terrible, horrible person that kills and plunders and rapes, and he's going to be terrible, and the person who says he's a Christian is going to be great. And no, that's not what's being said. It is not the case that a person who claims to be a Christian is going to behave in a Christian manner all the time. That's just a matter of fact. In fact, how many people have you known who have said they were Christians and yet their lives did not exhibit the principles of Jesus Christ? Nor is it a fact that a person who adheres to unbelief would be recognizably highly immoral. What I mean by that is a person who says he or she does not believe in God could be a very highly moral person in many respects. Could be a person who would never think about stealing. Could be a person who would not approach someone in a violent manner. Could be a person who would not think about any number of immoral activities. Don't misunderstand what's being said here. What is being said is not that a person who says he's a Christian is doing right and a person who says he doesn't believe in God is doing wrong. That's not what's being said. What is being said is that the philosophy of atheism leads to the logical conclusion of immorality. And the philosophy of Christianity, if practiced, leads to righteousness, goodness, and holiness. Now, let's ask ourselves, what does it mean that there are no ultimate foundations for ethics in unbelief? Charles Darwin said it very plainly. Here's what he said. A man who has no assured and ever-present belief in the existence of a personal God or of a future existence with retribution and reward can have for his rule of life, as far as I can see, only to follow those impulses and instincts which are the strongest or which seem the best to him. Now, William Provine says, hey, number one, there's no real foundation for ethics. Charles Darwin says, if you don't believe in God and you don't think that after this life there's going to be reward and retribution, the only thing you can really do is follow your instincts. Where would that lead? Suppose a person had an instinct to commit adultery. Would that be wrong? Would that be immoral? Would that be something that you could say is objectively morally wrong? Not according to atheism. You see, according to atheism, if there is no God, Darwin admits the best you can do is follow your instincts. If your instinct tells you that it's better to steal money than to work hard for it, the atheist has no grounds upon which to say that is wrong. Now, the atheist can say, I don't like that. The atheist can say, I don't think that'd be productive to society. The atheist can say, I think that would harm people, and anybody in this culture that tries that, we might try to put in prison or fine. But the atheist cannot say that is wrong. And here's what we all know. We all know that there are objective moral values. Some things are wrong, objectively, morally. They'll never be right. Under no circumstance would they be. Some things are right, objectively and morally. That is one of the fatal flaws of atheism. They cannot, the atheistic philosophy cannot make a morally objective statement. And now what I want you to understand is I'm not saying that. This is not Kyle Butt making that up. Who was the first person we quoted? William Provine, who is a devout atheist, well-known atheist, one of the leaders in the modern atheistic circles. Charles Darwin admitted such in his statement in his autobiography. Listen to the statement by Dan Barker. Dan Barker is the co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. He has a couple very well-known books that are sellers all over the country. One is Losing Faith in Faith. Another book that he has written is Godless. He says, there are no actions in and of themselves that are always absolutely right or wrong. It depends on the context. You cannot name an action that is always absolutely right or wrong. I can think of an exception in every case. I hope you're seeing where atheism, the philosophy of atheism, would lead. According to Barker, there is no action that you could ever say would be objectively, morally wrong. And I want you to see where that idea has led atheistic thinkers. But here's what I want you to understand as I go through this. I am not setting up a straw man. I am not making this up. You are about to read the atheistic leaders themselves on these topics. So understand that this is not Kyle Butt's opinion. This is the documented thinking by the representatives of atheism. Now, I don't even like to put this word on the screen. I don't even like to think about this topic, but I think that it has to be done in this context. I think it has to be done because the philosophy of atheism leads to the acceptance of extremely grotesque immorality. And I'm going to document that. If we were to say, is there an action that is wrong to commit? Well, this obviously would be one of those actions. If you were to ask the atheistic thinkers about this particular crime against another human, you would read a book by a man named Randy Thornhill. He lectured on this subject at the Simon Fraser University. He has a book about this subject with a man named Palmer, Randy Thornhill, and Palmer's name just left me, but I think I might have it on the next slide. In 2001, he said, this crime against another person is evolutionary, biological, and natural. Our male ancestors became ancestors in part because they conditionally used rape. Let me tell you where this leads. Dan Barker made the statement, no action in and of itself is wrong. Now, before I go any further, could we go to the Bible and ever justify this type of crime against humanity? Could we ever find any justification for this in the New Testament? Never, ever. In fact, if you were to just pull out a few of the verses that we mentioned about doing to others as you would have them to do to you, about loving one another as brothers, being tenderhearted, forgiving, etc., you could not find justification for this in any place in the Bible at all, whatsoever. Could you find justification for this using the philosophy of atheism? Dan Barker in 2005 debated a man by the name of Peter Payne. In that debate, he made the statement that you read on a previous slide. No action in and of itself is wrong. I can think of an exception in every case. They had a question and answer period after the debate. A student there at the university where the debate was held came to the microphone and said, I would like you to give me a scenario in which rape would be morally permissible. Dan Barker said, okay, this doesn't happen much. Some of these things would be so rare that you almost don't even need to discuss them, but I'll give you an example. He said, if aliens came down and said, we're going to kill everybody unless you do this to a person, then it would be morally right to do that. Okay? I debated Dan Barker in 2009 on the campus of the University of South Carolina. In that debate, I said, Dan Barker, you've made the statement that this would be morally permissible. I said, what about two women? He said, yeah. I said, what about 2,000? He said, yes. I said, what about 2 million? He said, it would be my moral obligation if it was going to save all of humanity to commit that crime against 2 million women. Now, I thought that if I somehow got him to say that in public, that any person who associated themselves with atheism would immediately distance themselves from the idea, be flabbergasted and horrified that one of the leaders of the atheistic community would say that in public. I knew he thought it. I didn't think he'd say it. And yet, not only did he say it would be morally permissible, he said it would be your moral obligation. Now, the crowd of 550 people was composed of about 450 members of the Lord's church. There was an obvious, recognizable gasp when he said that would be his moral obligation. You could look out in the audience and see that the people were highly offended and taken aback. And he looked out at the audience and then at me and he said, well, yeah, but you would thank me because I would save your life. And I said, no, Dan, we would never thank you because we know that there's somewhere better that we're going after this life. He said, you don't know that. And I said, yes, we do. I could not imagine hearing a person say that, admitting that's where atheism leads, and continuing to adhere to that kind of unbelief. But that's what we're dealing with. Now, if we were to go to another idea, abortion and atheism, you understand that in 2001, when those terrorists hijacked those planes and flew them into the Twin Towers, flew them into the Pentagon, that day there were about 2,450 United States citizens killed. Of course, George W. Bush was irate. He got on international television. He gave an impassioned speech in which he said that we would not let this crime go unpunished, that we were going to hunt down the people who had committed this act of terrorism, that we were going to bring them to justice, and we were going to bring every country that was harboring these types of people to justice as well. I don't know if you remember that speech. I remember it very well. That day, in the United States of America, we killed 2,450 of our own citizens with a pair of scissors or saline solution or a pill. The day before that, we killed 2,450 of our own citizens. The day before that, about 2,500. The day before that, about 2,500. Since 1973, we've been killing 2,500 of our own citizens every single day to the tune of 50 million of them. We've killed an entire generation of the population of the United States of America. We called it abortion instead of murder, swept it under the rug, and you didn't hear a speech from George W. Bush coming out and saying, we're going to bring the people to justice who are killing unborn children. Now, let me ask you a question. Where could you go to justify killing 50 million innocent children? Could you go to the Bible? Proverbs chapter 6 says that the Lord hates the hands that shed innocent blood. Throughout the Bible, the idea of murder is condemned. If you were to go to the New Testament, you hear Jesus saying to the rich young ruler when he said, "What commandments do I need to keep?" Jesus said, do not murder. Humans do not have the prerogative to indiscriminately kill innocent people who have committed no crime. Where could you go to justify that kind of brutality? Could you go to atheism? Barbara Burke wrote in 1974, among some animal species, infant killing appears to be a natural practice. Could it be natural for humans too? A trait inherited from our primate ancestors? Charles Darwin noted in The Sin of Man that infanticide has been probably the most important of all checks on population growth throughout most of human history. You hear what Barbara Burke is saying? She says, hey, if we are nothing more than animals and animals kill their babies, then we have the right, we have the prerogative, indiscriminately we can kill our children too. My dad and brothers were into coon hunting up in Tennessee. They bought a coon dog. Her name is Queen. She was phenomenal, had a pedigree as long as your arm. She was going to have puppies that they thought were going to be worth about $500 to $1,000 bucks a piece. She had 12 puppies in her first litter. They thought, wow, this is great. She ate every one of them but one. She thought she could only raise one puppy at a time. She had another litter of 8, killed all of them except one. 10% of the Komodo diets, the Komodo dragons, adult Komodo dragon, 10% of their diet is baby Komodo dragons. If you've ever raised pigs, you understand that if you want to keep any of your piglets, you had better get them away from the boar because he will kill them. If you've watched the Planet Earth series from, I think it's National Geographic, you saw that polar bears, adult male polar bears, guess what they like to eat? Baby polar bears. Now, Barbara Burke's saying, look, if you're just an animal, animals control their population by killing their babies. Could humans do that too? Continue with me. I want you to read a statement by a man named Peter Singer. Now, before you do, I know that it's hard to listen while the statement is up, but try to listen to what I'm about to say. Dan Barker called Peter Singer the leading ethicist in the world. Singer is an atheist. He was interviewed by Richard Dawkins. Dawkins is recognized probably as the leading atheist in the world. Dawkins said of Singer that he is the most moral man that Richard Dawkins knows to be alive. So what I'm trying to tell you by that is that this guy is no slouch in the atheistic community. He is recognized as the leading ethicist. Now, Barker says in the world. But if we were just to say in the atheistic community, does he accurately represent a majority of atheistic thinkers along these lines? The answer is yes, he does. As evidenced by Richard Dawkins saying he's one of the most highly moral people that he knows in existence. Now here's what Singer says. If we compare a severely defective human infant with a non-human animal, a dog or a pig, for example, we'll often find the non-human to have superior capacities. Only the fact that the defective infant is a member of the species Homo sapiens leads it to be treated differently from the dog or the pig. Species membership alone, however, is not morally relevant. Now let's cut through that and see what he's saying. He says, look, you got a dog, a pig, and a human. Most of the time, historically, we've kept a human alive for one reason. Not because it's going to be smarter, not because it's going to be more productive to society. We've kept a human alive for one reason. What was that? The human was human. That's all. But he says species membership is not morally relevant. Let me show you what he means. If we can put aside the obsolete and erroneous notion of the sanctity of all human life, we may start to look at human life as it really is. Do you understand where he's going with this? According to atheism, there are no ultimate foundations for ethics. According to atheism, you are a blob of primordial slime that has evolved over millions of years. If that is the case, and all organisms are blobs of primordial slime that have evolved over millions of years, then what makes human slime any more valuable to keep alive than pig slime or dog slime, etc.? Now, you understand that the founders of this country said, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. And among those rights are the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, where do the human rights of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness originate? From a Creator. You see, the reason that you should be kept alive is not because you can run faster than the person sitting next to you. It's not because you're smarter. It's not because you're more beautiful. It's not because you have something necessarily productive even to offer society, although you do. The reason that you're supposed to be valued is because you're made in the image of God. And nobody can ever take that away from you. You are a human made in the image of God, endowed by your Creator with inalienable rights, rights that cannot be stripped from you unless you get rid of the statement, endowed by your Creator. See, if there's no Creator that endowed you with inalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, if you're not made in the image of God and you are just primordial slime evolved over multiplied millions of years, then of what value really are you if you're not smarter than the dog or the pig? If you're not going to be more productive, then why keep you around? That's what Peter Singer is saying, but you don't have to take my word for it. Let's continue. In his article, The Writings on an Ethical Life, he says that a fetus is known to be disabled is widely accepted as ground for abortion. Now stop right there. I, of course, don't agree with this statement. What he's saying is, if you find before a child is born that it's going to be a Down syndrome child, he says everybody recognizes that you could abort that fetus. Now, we would not recognize that. We would say that's not true, but the people to whom he is writing would all agree with that statement. Watch what he continues to say, however. Yet in discussing abortion, we say that birth doesn't mark a morally significant dividing line. I can't see how someone could defend the view that fetuses can be replaced before birth, but newborn infants can't. Okay, you see where he's going with that. He says, we've always said that if you find something wrong with an unborn child, you could kill it while it's in its mother's womb and you wouldn't be morally responsible for that. But then we say once the child is born, the second it's born, now it has all kinds of moral rights. He said, I don't see how anybody can defend that idea. That a second after a child is born, it's got rights, but a second before it doesn't. Well, we've been saying that all along. We've been saying that a human from conception has the inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness that are endowed by the Creator. We have been making this statement for years. Birth is not a morally dividing line. The Bible, from first to last, views humans from conception as being fully human. Talks about babies in utero as if they were babies outside of the mother's womb. Uses the same words. See, in one sense, we would totally agree with Peter Singer on this. We'd say, yes, that's exactly right. Why do you think you can kill a baby before it's born, but you can't afterward? Now, what we would hope he would do is then move in the right direction and say, okay, if birth's not a morally dividing line, well, let's back it up. And if we can't kill a newborn, then we can't kill an 8-month gestating baby. And if we can't kill an 8-month, we can't kill a 7. And we can't kill a 7, we can't kill a 6. That's what you'd hope he'd say. No. It's not what he does say. He says, look, guys, if birth is not a morally dividing line, then why are we saying we should have to keep newborns alive? He says, if a disabled infant were not regarded as having a right to life until, say, a week or a month after birth, it would allow parents, in consultation with their doctors, to choose on the basis of far greater knowledge of the infant's condition than is possible before birth. He says, look, guys, everybody admits in his circle of friends that you could abort a baby if there was something wrong with it. He says, but then they make the foolish statement that once it's born, you couldn't kill it. But what he's contending is, sure you could. If you just said, you know what about after 2 weeks or a month? If the doctor, in consultation with the parents, feel like this child is not going to be productive to society, why don't you just allow them to kill that baby as well? We let them kill babies that are growing in their mother's womb. Why not just let them kill babies that have been born for a month? Is that immoral? Yes. Does it naturally follow from the idea of atheism to which he is adhering? It does. This man is a representative of well-thought-through atheism. And what I mean by that is he is propounding for us the logical consequences of the belief that there is no God. He says, nevertheless, the main point is clear. Killing a disabled infant is not morally equivalent to killing a person. Very often it's not wrong at all. Continue with me. James Rachels, advocating these same types of ideas. He says, an infant with severe brain damage, even if it survives for many years, it may never learn to speak. Its mental powers may never rise above a primitive level. In fact, its psychological capacities may be markedly inferior to those of a typical rhesus monkey. In that case, moral individualism would see no reason to prefer its life over the monkey's. You see where we're going with this? Look, if you're just an animal and an animal happens to be smarter than the child that you've given birth to that has some brain damage, then you keep the monkey alive and you eliminate the child. He says some unfortunate humans, perhaps because they have suffered brain damage, they're not rational agents. What do you say about them? The natural conclusion, according to the doctrine we're considering, would be that their status is that of mere animals. And perhaps we should go on to conclude that they may be used as non-human animals are used, perhaps as laboratory subjects or as food. Now, lest you think that I am cherry-picking these types of writings for shock value, let me explain to you. I have working with me an intern who is enrolled at State University, who recently, as of yesterday, explained to me that his philosophy teacher was a great fan and follower of both Peter Singer and James Rachels because of their stand for animal rights. Well, you see where they're getting the undergirding for their stand for animal rights. Hey, animals are as important as humans or more, depending on how valuable they're going to be to society. These men are the representatives, in many cases, of logically thought through atheism. Nietzsche said this. He said, we believe that severity, violence, slavery, danger in the street and in the heart, secrecy, stoicism, tempter's art, devilry of every kind, that everything terrible, wicked, tyrannical, predatory, serpentine in man serves as well for the elevation of the human species as its opposite. Now, you understand what he was saying. If we are evolving, then it might look like some of this stuff that you consider immoral is bad. But if it eliminates some type of negative trait from the human gene pool, then it could be a great thing. For instance, I was down in Montgomery. There were a couple guys that saw a man driving an F-150 Ford truck. They liked his truck. His wife had called him on the cell phone, asked him to stop in and pick up some milk and bread. He went to Walmart, picked up some milk and bread, came out to the Walmart parking lot. Those two individuals were standing by his truck. They shot him, killed him dead, took his keys and drove off in his truck. Anything wrong with that? Most people would say absolutely, positively, there's something morally wrong with that. That's debased, that's wrong, that's morally depraved. You can't shoot a man for his truck. Now, what Nietzsche is saying is we need to get beyond this idea of good and evil, like that's evil and helping the man to his truck with his groceries would be good, because we need to see what might have really just happened there. These two men might be more fit than the man they just shot. In fact, apparently they're smart enough to kill him fairly easily. And so because of their intelligence or their fitness, they have eliminated someone that was potentially harmful for the elevation of the human species. So while you might look at that and say it's morally wrong, something that you would consider to be objectively morally bad, shooting somebody and taking their truck just because you like it, Nietzsche would say, no, you can't look at it that way. You've got to look at it from an atheistic evolutionary point of view. Could that have helped humans evolve further? Well, if it could have, let's get beyond good and evil and let's start looking at this for what it really is. And it's just an action that happens that could be elevating the human species. Is that wrong? Yes, it's wrong. Is it morally depraved? Yes, it is. Is that the logical consequence of atheism? It is. In 2006, a man by the name of Dr. Eric Pianka was elected as the Distinguished Texas Scientist of the Year for the entire state of Texas, one of the largest states in the union, of course. Having one of the largest populations of teachers and school systems, etc. He was standing before an audience of about 400 distinguished scientists and educators. One of the people in charge of this particular program asked the cameraman not to video what Pianka was about to say. Pianka studies reptiles. He stood before that group of 400 distinguished scientists and educators and said, humans are no better than bacteria, that 90% of the current population of humanity needs to be eliminated because we are killing other organisms, we're taking over, and we need to make room for bacteria and reptiles and frogs, etc. He said, what I think would be a viable option would be airborne Ebola virus. It kills fairly rapidly in 3 or 4 days, and it doesn't leave a prolonged situation of painful death. I think we could probably think about eliminating 90% of the human population if we were to go that way by using something like Ebola virus. His justification for that was that humans are no better than bacteria because we're all just evolved from the same initial organism, primordial slime. Now, this is a statement from one of the students who listened to Dr. Pianka's speech. Dr. Pianka's talk at the TAS meeting was mostly of the problems humans are causing as we rapidly proliferate around the globe. He's a radical thinker, that one. I mean, he's basically advocating for the death of all but 10% of the current population, and at the risk of sounding just as radical, I think he's right. I think it was 3 weeks ago now, and maybe two. I was in Brandon, Mississippi, doing a seminar very similar to this. And there were in the audience, as there may be here, I don't know, about 4 atheistic thinkers. People who, as I delivered what I was saying, you could tell they certainly did not agree with anything that I was saying. They were angered by my statements and later came up to me afterward and said, look, we've done some public speaking and we know exactly what you're about here. The things that you presented were for sheer shock value. You put those things like the death of humanity and abortion and rape up so that people would hate atheists and be afraid of atheists. I said, no, I did not. I said, number one, I admitted out front that there may be people who call themselves Christians who are highly immoral. And there may be people who call themselves atheists who are highly moral in many respects. I never wanted anyone to be afraid of atheists. But I did say, I do believe that the philosophy of atheism is a very dangerous, destructive philosophy. Well, the girl who was arguing with me said, the shock value of saying that we need to kill 90% of the population, how do you feel right using that? And then within a sentence, she said, but I'll tell you what, I think Bianca's right. I've always hated being a human, and I do believe we need to eliminate 90% of them. Now, I looked at her other three atheist friends, and I said, did you hear that? I said, she just accused me of saying I was using this information for nothing but shock value, but then admitted she believes exactly what I'm saying. Now, what I want you to understand is that atheism leads to destructive, immoral practices if put into practice. And that's why in Psalm 14:1, the Bible can say, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. There is none who does good, no, not one. Because if you put atheism into practice, it leads to this. And you can deny that it does all you want, and you can say, it wouldn't lead me to that, but you can't say it's morally wrong for it to lead to this. You can say, I don't like it, it wouldn't be productive to society, but you cannot say, on the foundation of atheism, that it's morally wrong. Continue with me. I don't know if you remember Jeffrey Dahmer. Several years ago, Jeffrey Dahmer killed 19 young men and boys. He was convicted of 17 accounts of first-degree murder, did horrible things to them, the likes of which would literally turn your stomach if we were to describe them. Jeffrey Dahmer said, in an interview with Stone Phillips in, oh, I think it was 1994, Stone Phillips said, where in the world did you get the idea that you could murder people indiscriminately? Jeffrey Dahmer said this, if a person doesn't think that there is a God to be accountable to, then what's the point of trying to modify your behavior to keep it within acceptable ranges? That's how I thought anyway. Now, you can disagree with Dahmer. You can say, no, that's not where atheism leads, etc. But when Dahmer was asked, why'd you kill people? He said, I thought I had the right to because I thought they were evolved primordial slime and I thought I was evolved primordial slime and I didn't think that anybody really cared. And I didn't think I was morally responsible to anybody. Now, according to Charles Darwin, if there is no God, then a person follows the instincts and impulses that seem the strongest to him. What instincts and impulses was Jeffrey Dahmer following? The ones that seemed the strongest to him. Now, according to Darwin, could you say you don't like that? Yeah. Could you say you wouldn't want that in your neighborhood? Yeah. Could you say it's morally wrong? I said you could not. Stone Phillips asked Dahmer, he said, well, when did you change? When did your mind change and you realize you had done something wrong to people, to your fellow humans? When did the realization hit you that you murdered real people? He looked over at his dad, Lionel, who was in the interview with him, and he said, Dad, when you sent me those creation evolution materials, those Christian science materials, I realized that there was a God who had created us and I realized I had done something wrong to my fellow humans. Now I believe that Jeffrey Dahmer is a perfect example of someone who was putting into practice the philosophy of atheism. Exactly doing what Charles Darwin said a person would do if he did not believe in a God or an afterlife of retribution and reward. That's the statement he made. And this is the statement he made in his life and letters. There is no fundamental difference between man and the higher mammals in their mental faculties. He said, you know what, guess what? You might be a little bit smarter than a monkey that might be sitting next to you on the chair, but it's just a difference of degree. It's not a difference of kind. I mean, you might be a little smarter than the person that's sitting next to you on the chair, but that doesn't mean you have a different kind of intelligence, just a different degree. He said, and ultimately, you could just put an animal down there on the chair next to you, and if you were to compare your kinds of intelligence, there would be no difference. Yeah, you might be smarter in some areas. If you had a brain-damaged individual, that brain-damaged individual would be less intelligent in many areas, and so that animal would be worthy of more moral treatment than the human. A man by the name of William Ernest Henley wrote a poem called Invictus. That was a statement that served as the last words of a man by the name of Timothy McVeigh. You might recognize that name. Timothy McVeigh took a moving truck, filled it with explosives, drove it into the Oklahoma government building, ignited it, killed about 163 people, killed about 13 children at a daycare, 5 years old or younger. When they asked him about killing 13 children, he said, that's just collateral damage for the kind of message I was needing to send. He was sentenced to death, was killed by lethal injection. The last thing he ever wrote, he didn't have any last words, he just wrote the poem Invictus. Out of the dark that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced or cried aloud under the bludgeonings of chance. My head is bloody but unbowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears lies but the horror of the shade. And yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll, I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. William Ernest Henley, the man who wrote that poem, was a humanist who did not believe in God and was convinced that if there was a loving God, he could not have allowed Henley to suffer the way that he did. Henley had tuberculosis when he was 16, had one of his legs removed. In a freak accident at about the age of 42, a chain wrapped around his leg and he was drugged down a train track. His tuberculosis of the bone set back in. He thought he was going to have the other leg amputated as well. Lived a very painful life, died in his 50s. Believed there just simply couldn't be a personal loving God who would allow that to happen. If you'll notice what McVeigh and Henley were trying to do, they were trying to convince the world that they were not afraid to die. That regardless of what awaited them, they were the masters of their fate, they were the captains of their soul, that they had lived the way that they had wanted to live, and they were proud of what they had done, and they didn't need to rely on the belief of a God. But I want you to look deep into that poem and see the most bitter fruit of atheism. Beyond this place of wrath and tears lies but the horror of the shade. Do you know what the most bitter fruit of atheism is? The most bitter fruit of atheism is the idea that this world cannot account for the next. And regardless of how unbelief would like to paint the picture of what happens after death, the fact of the matter is that God has set eternity in our hearts, and the only possible deep down emotion that can be felt about looking into eternity was stated very clearly by Henley and McVeigh. Beyond this place of wrath and tears lies but the horror of the shade. A young lady by the name of Dorothea Day listened to Henley, was enamored with his humanism, accepted it, adopted it as her philosophy for a while until she was introduced to the teachings of Jesus Christ. And she wrote a response to Henley. And she said, "Out of the light that dazzles me, bright as the sun from pole to pole, I thank the God I know to be, for Christ is the conqueror of my soul. Since He is the sway of circumstance, I would not wince nor cry aloud under the rule which men call chance. My head with joy is humbly bound. Beyond this place of sin and tears, that life with Him and His the aid, despite the menace of the years, keeps and shall keep me unafraid. I have no fear, though straight the gate, He cleared my punishment from the scroll. Christ is the master of my fate. Christ is the captain of my soul." There's only one possible way that you can look into eternity and have the confidence to say, "I am ready." And that's if you can honestly make the statement, "Christ is the captain of my soul." I sincerely appreciate your kind attention. You have listened very well. I appreciate your being here this evening. We are going to have a question and answer period that we will take anywhere from 5 to 20 minutes regarding the question and answers, depending on the questions that we have. Before we do, let me say that we have a couple things in the back as you exit. To the right, there is a table of free material that Apologetics Press is putting out. It's got some of our resources that come out monthly, some samples of our monthly journals for children and for adults. We've also got some of our tracts. On that table, there is an email sign-up sheet every week, every Monday, we write new articles that we send out. Right now, I think we're sending them out to about 10,000 folks or so. We'll write articles on, depending on what the latest discovery or find or idea is. Sometimes it'll be an alleged human ancestor that will be written about, and we'll write about that and put that out. If you wanted to get that weekly update, you could put your email address there, and you could get that. We also have on the left side books that are for sale. We are a nonprofit organization. That means we are professional money losers. We do it every year. We lose money. We're great at it. We've been losing money for about 32 years now. We're getting to be very good at it. The reason that we do is because we don't really care to make money on any of this stuff. In fact, most every bit of that material out there is free on our website. This book right here, you can get every bit of it free on our website. It's called A Christian's Guide to Refuting Modern Atheism. It is a copy of the transcript of the debate I had with Dan Barker. About the first 60 pages or so, and the other 200 pages or so are a refutation of all the things he stated in the debate that we didn't have time to address. This debate is Does God Exist? It's the debate that I had with Barker. It's on our website free. The articles that we have out there on our website, I think we've got about 3,000, 3,500 of those. They're free. We've got an entire section of e-books that are totally free. You can get on the website, download them. We try to make every bit of our material completely free. When I say every bit, what I mean is every bit of information that you would need to address these topics is on there that you can get. Now, some people still like a hard copy book that they can write in and put on their shelf. They still like a DVD that they can put on their shelf instead of going to their computer and watching on their computer. They like to just pull it out and put it in their DVD player. Okay, great. If you want one of those, you can get one of these DVDs for $5. If you want one of those, you can get one of these books right here for $5. Everything on that table is $5 except some cardboard DVDs, and they're, I think, $2 or $3 a piece. We try to make it so that price would never, ever keep a person from getting our material. In fact, if you say, "Kyle, I don't have $5 and I want one of those books," well, okay, take it. We are not in the business of making money. We want you to have the material. But, hey, we put it out there. If you want it, take it. If you want it off our internet, it's free. We ask for $5 for some of the stuff, but if you can't pay us $5, that's great. We want you to have the material regardless of how you get it, okay? Everybody understand that? All right. Now, of course, there is only one rule for question and answers. It's pretty simple. As you ask a question, you can only ask questions to which I know the answer. That's the only rule. You stick with that. We'll have a fine question and answer. You get beyond that, we're going to be in trouble. I think we're going to take a microphone around, are we? And if you've got a question, feel free to ask the question. In your mind, be thinking of the music to Jeopardy. Sometimes these last long. Sometimes they go about 2 minutes. Yes, sir. Hold on. Let's get the microphone to you. Right here, man in the blue striped shirt.
What about the killing of babies and other seemingly innocent people when Israel would take over Canaan?
Look, great question. He said, what about the killing of seemingly innocent people when the Israelites would take over Canaan? If you were to look in the Bible and ask the simple question, did God periodically kill thousands or even millions of what we would consider to be innocent people? Absolutely positively. That is not even under discussion as far as nobody denies that. In the flood, they estimated that there were about 2 billion people in the flood. When God came down and wiped out via water everybody in the world, did he destroy all of the innocent babies that were there on the world during the flood? Absolutely positively. So if you were going to answer this question, you would not say, no, God's never killed innocent people. That's yes. Everyone admits that God has periodically and systematically killed some innocent children. And if we were to say, how many? Well, it could be in the millions. The first way that I would address that, and I do in the book, you know, Christian's Guide to Refuting Modern Atheism, the first thing to do there is say, okay, first, let's admit that when God went into, when he sent the children of Israel into the land of Canaan, many of the people were wicked and deserved the death penalty. Now, if you are to start there, eventually, every skeptic that I've discussed this with has to admit, okay, that could be a possibility. So you say, all right, could some of those people have committed such crimes that they deserve to be punished by death? Well, the answer to that is yes. If you were to look at several passages in Deuteronomy and Exodus as to the crimes that these individuals committed. They were allowing their children to pass through the fire to Molech. They were indiscriminately killing innocent children themselves. And so could some of them have deserved the death penalty? Yes. So generally speaking, what happens, and this is a little bit longer explanation than 2 minutes, but let me give you the how you systematically go through it. The first thing you say is, okay, number one, would you admit that under certain circumstances, if a person committed a crime worthy of death, they could be killed? Okay, when that happens, Dan Barker debating Peter Payne, Peter Payne said, hey, weren't some of these people criminals? Barker said, yes, some of them were criminals, and they might could have justifiably been killed. But what about the fetuses? What about the unborn babies or the innocent children? Now, let's stop right there and ask this question. Does atheism have a problem killing unborn children or infants? You see, what's happening here is the atheistic community is saying, well, hold on just a second. You are saying that your God would kill innocent children, and that's morally wrong. Well, it's not morally wrong according to atheism. What did Peter Singer say we could do? Peter Singer said you could kill innocent children if they were brain damaged, or if they weren't going to be productive to society. So if we were to say, does atheism contend that it's morally wrong to kill children? Well, the philosophy of atheism cannot. They cannot say, we believe it's morally wrong to kill children. So in that case, then, basically what the atheist is saying is, well, I just don't think God should be the one to say when children die. Well, who do they think? Who would atheism contend would be the one to say when children should be able to die? Well, you know where that's going. Well, that's going to the atheistic community should be the one that says when children should be able to die if they are unborn, if they are going to be damaged, if they're going to have some type of debilitating disease, etc. So let's clear the air and say, okay, you're not contending that it's morally wrong to kill innocent children. You're just contending you don't think that God of the Bible should be the one that says when it should happen. Now, Then we need to ask this question. According to atheism, what does a person who kills a child take from the child? Everything. According to atheism, this life is all you got. In fact, Dan Barker says this life is all that you have. It is fragile. It is brief. And you need to enjoy it while you have it. So if atheism contends that this life is all you have, and atheism would say, yeah, we could kill some disabled infants, then what is the atheist saying that he thinks it's right to do? Take from the child all that there is. Now, according to the Bible, what happens to an innocent child that dies? Well, according to the Bible, if an innocent child dies, that innocent child goes to paradise. And so the atheist is contending, well, God's doing something terrible against innocent children. Well, no, if you're taking the Bible as a whole and you're admitting that there is a soul that will live forever, and that if an innocent child dies, that innocent child is going to paradise, then God is not taking all that there is from the child. God is swapping a brief physical life for an eternal life of bliss. So then you ask the simple question, well, who is God wronging in this case? Is God wronging the innocent child that he's allowing to go to heaven? Well, see, you couldn't say that God is wronging the innocent child. And so what happens then is it moves to the discussion of, well, you can't prove that there is an eternal life after this. Well, hold on just a second. If you can prove that there's eternal life after this, and we can, then is God immoral for giving an innocent child eternal life and taking a brief physical life away from him? No. And what you'll find the atheistic community admits is, okay, if there is an eternal life, then okay, you're fine. But there's no eternal life. Well, the same Bible that says God ordered the killing of innocent children is the same Bible that talks about immortal eternal life. So why in the world would you take the idea that God actually did order the killing of innocent children, but you wouldn't accept the idea of eternal life? You see, there's some cherry picking involved. Okay, once you establish that, once you nail down the fact that, okay, you can't say God's wrong in these kids because he's sending them to eternal bliss, then the argument moves, and I've seen it 100 times move. Here's where it goes. Well, okay, well, if you're saying then that, why don't you just kill all innocent kids so that they all go to heaven? Okay, you know, I understand what you're saying there. Why not just, when you baptize somebody, right when they come out of the water, shoot them in the head, boom, they go to heaven, everybody's happy. Okay, you see where that's going, though? The simple question is, who has the prerogative to decide when physical life should be over? Now, if you want there again to refer to the atheistic writings, Barker in his book Godless says, in order to make moral decisions, here's what you should do. Know as much about the consequences as possible. He said, sometimes you're going to make mistakes, but if you know as much about the consequences as possible, that's when you're in a position to know how to make the most moral decision. Okay, there, now let's ask this question. Who knows the most about the consequences? A human or an omniscient God who knows everything? So according to their own thinking, who would be in the best position to decide when physical life should end? Well, somebody who knows everything. And who does know everything? God. So you see that they can't accuse God of being cruel or mean because he's taking an innocent child to paradise. But then they can't contend that we should be able to kill all innocent people if we want to because God hasn't given us that prerogative. We don't know when a physical life would be moral to take or not, unless God has explained that. And so that would be the brief 5-minute answer to an extended, 15-30 minute discussion of that in the book. Good question. Very good question. Right over here.
Where does the idea of agnosticism fit into this?
Okay. He says, where's the idea of agnosticism fit into this? I'm very glad he asked that, and here's why. In April of next year, I'm going to be debating a man by the name of Bart Ehrman. Bart Ehrman is a three-time New York Times bestseller. He recently wrote a best-selling book called God's Problem. That book deals with the problem of evil, pain, and suffering, and he says, and here's where agnosticism comes in. He says, the evil, pain, and suffering in the world make it impossible for me to believe that there's an all-loving God like you read about in the Bible. So I said to him, I said, okay, Bart, can we then say in our proposition of our debate, the evil, pain, and suffering make it impossible to believe that there's an all-loving God? He said, no, you can't say that. He said, it makes it impossible for me to believe that. But I'm not going to say that another person couldn't. And so I'm not going to say that it's impossible. I'm going to say it's highly improbable. And I just don't think so, but there's not enough evidence to make a conclusive statement, and so I'm going to contend it's impossible for me, but somebody might could. Now, the atheist would say, generally speaking, the hard-nosed atheist would say, it's impossible to believe in a God. I know that there's not one, and nobody else could ever, rightly thinking, believe that there is one himself. Now, just to parse the two words for you, or break them down or whatever, atheism comes from the two Greek words theos, and the prefix, I guess the prefix is not a word, a, meaning no God. If you put a in front of something in Greek, it means no. Agnostic comes from a gnosis, meaning no knowledge. The agnostic just simply says, I don't think this is the case, but I don't have infinite knowledge of everything in the universe, and I might be wrong, and so I'm not going to say it's impossible. And that's where that would come in. In fact, the way that Ehrman put it in his debate I was watching with D'Souza, he said, the awe-inspiring nature of the universe calls for at least a little bit of humility. And I just can't say there is no God for sure. I just don't think there is one. Good question. Look, why don't you guys on the same side of the auditorium, like if there's anybody over here with a question, I mean, you're just trying to run my man to death, huh? I'll tell you what. Hope you got on tennis shoes back there, brother.
Thanks, sir. Okay, so what would you say is a good common starting place for just an average person who, you know, might be in high school or college, who meets a fellow student who's agnostic or atheist, you know, because obviously you start to talk about the Bible, it's hard to have a common starting point if they don't believe in the Bible.
Right.
You know, so would you start with maybe a moral argument or a philosophical argument, or where have you found is the best, you know, kind of building point?
Right.
To go from there.
Let me answer that question by saying this. Atheism is false. It's incorrect. And that's a fact. No one has arrived at atheism based on correct thinking about evidence. And so to think that if I present the evidence correctly and forcefully, it's going to change an atheistic person's mind might not be the right approach. But I do believe 1 Peter chapter 3:15 calls upon us to be able to defend everything that we say and give a defense, give it a rational, a reason for the hope that is within us. So I'm not saying don't answer the question, but I am saying the fact that a person adheres to atheism is because somewhere along the way, the reasoning process has been twisted. And just like when the people saw Lazarus rise from the grave, they should have said, Jesus is the Son of God. Nobody could do that except somebody speaking for God. Instead, they said, we need to kill Lazarus because people are believing on Jesus because of Lazarus. Well, now, here was the evidence. Lazarus rose from the grave because Jesus brought him back in a miracle. That's the evidence. The response to people who didn't want to believe was, let's kill Lazarus. Now, what I find to be the most effective is to, and now here's what generally happens with my discussions with atheists. In fact, I had a guy come up to me after the Brandon, Mississippi seminar, and he said, well, there's just so many problems with the Bible, I can't even begin to list them all. And I said, well, why don't you just give me one? He said, well, there are just too many of them. And he pulled out a sheet that had, in minuscule writing, hundreds of contradictions, maybe thousands. And then he closed the sheet. He showed it to me. He said, look, see, here it is. And he closed it. I said, well, hold on just a second. Let's look at that. And I asked him to open it again. He said, well, you can't even read all these. There are just so many of them. And I said, hold on just a second. What do you think is the most powerful one you've got? Well, and then he gave me, well, the Bible is contradicted because of how it deals with baptism. And I said, well, give me an example. He said, well, what about over in Romans 10, 9 and 10, where it says, if you confess with your mouth, believe in your heart, you're saved. And then in Acts chapter 2, it says, you got to be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins to be saved. What about that? That's a contradiction. And I said, well, you know, over in Romans chapter 6, these people in the Roman church were already baptized. That wasn't even under discussion. They had become Christians by being baptized because, then I quoted in Romans 6, 3 through 6, don't you know, as many of you as were baptized into Christ were baptized into his death. Well, right when I said that, he said, yeah, but what about, and he went to something else. So what I think you have to do in any discussion like this is take it very seriously and approach it out of kindness. Let your speech be seasoned with salt. But narrow it down to the one topic they want to discuss, whether it's Bible contradictions, whether it's the existence of God, evidence from science, whatever. But force the discussion to be on one small aspect of that. Okay, we're not going to discuss alleged Bible contradictions. We're going to discuss a single alleged Bible contradiction. And until you and I hammer that out, we're going no further. Because what normally happens is, well, yeah, but then what about... Well, now, hold on. Let's deal with this one right here. And then move on. So generally speaking, it depends on the atheist coming to you and the problem they've got. Sometimes it's alleged Bible contradiction. Sometimes it's the proof of evolution. You know, I had a guy write us, and he said, y'all are idiots. Everything on your website's ridiculous. Y'all need to move into the 21st century because everybody knows evolution's a fact. And I said, hey, you know, we appreciate feedback. Even when it's negative, we would respectfully disagree. But, What one piece of evidence would you think proves evolution? Well, he wrote me back. And he said, well, humans have gill slits when they're embryos, and that proves that they evolved from fish. Well, that's been debunked since 1880 from Ernst Haeckel. We've known that's false. So I write him and I say, okay, no, you said everything on our site is false. I ask you for one thing. You gave me as a piece of evidence that humans evolved from our other organisms and gill slits were evidence of that. Here's the article that proves that wasn't the case. Well, then he wrote back to me and said, you guys are all still idiots. Okay? And what can you do with that? Nothing. So answer the question in a very kind way and make sure you narrow it down to a singular idea that a right-thinking person is forced to admit, okay, that's the truth of it. That's what I do. Okay, other questions? We got 3 more minutes. Time for 1/3 of a question. Yes, back here. You did that on purpose, didn't you? Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, that's true. It's true.
You mentioned 2 men in particular, I can't remember their names. The first man, he said he would be morally obligated to do harm to up to 2 million women, possibly more, to save the human race. What was his name?
His name was Dan Barker, made that statement in our debate in 2009. It's on YouTube if you want to type in Dan Barker and rape. You'll get that.
The second man, we needed to eliminate up to 90% of the human race. What was his name?
A-N-K-A. And he was a 2006 Distinguished Scientist of the Year. And a man by the name of Forrest Mims wrote an article about the speech that he gave. And if you wanted to look up Forrest Mims, M-I-M-S, or Eric Pianka, it'd be good.
And both of these men are professed atheists, is that correct?
Yes.
Does anybody know if anyone has asked Mr. Barker if he should forcefully take action against this man? Since he has stated exactly the posthumous that was presented to him.
Right. Now, in that discussion, what you're going to find is that most all of this stuff is very theoretical to them. It's very academic and theoretical, and when Pianka says, hey, we should eliminate 90% of the human population, he doesn't mean he's going to go out and do it. And he doesn't mean that you should find somebody to forcefully do it. He's just saying if that were to occur, you couldn't say it's morally wrong. In fact, it would allow more organisms to flourish. So it might be a good thing if we had an outbreak of Ebola and that happened. So it's not as if Dan Barker is running around thinking I need to put into practice what my atheism logically leads to. And that's the whole point, I guess, of this discussion. I'm not saying that atheists are forcefully putting this into practice necessarily. Now, some in the past have. Joseph Stalin was an atheist, and he did kill, boasted that he killed tens of millions of Russian peasants. But what I'm saying is that's where atheism, the philosophy and the thinking, leads a person. And if you were to read Dostoevsky's book, The Brothers Karamazov, he says in that book, if there is no God, all things are permissible. And that's ultimately where it's going, at least philosophical and theoretically. And then when you take places like liberal in practice. Good question. All right, I guess that'll be all for this evening. We will have another lesson tomorrow night, and it will be on this topic. Does the Bible show the idea that women are inferior or less valuable than men? The atheistic community attacks the Bible and Bible writers and preachers, etc., because they claim that the Bible shows a very sexist, gender-biased form of writing, and that women are viewed as inferior, males are viewed as superior. Is that true? Is that allegation, does it withstand scrutiny when looking at what the Bible really says? And so we'll be discussing that tomorrow evening and hope that you will be here with us. I think that they have some activities starting at 4:30, and Glenn is going to come and tell us all about that.